we have the parsha of Pekudei. The parsha begins Eile Pekudei HaMishkan. This is the reckoning of all the materials. The Torah says exactly what went for what. As Rabbi Meir Shapira, no stranger to fundraising himself, used to say, when it comes to donations, everyone wants a receipt, everyone wants a reckoning, exactly where their money went. And that's how the parsha begins. Pekudei HaMishkan. This is the reckoning of the Mishkan. Pekudei, as we know, is a form of counting. And interestingly, we know as well, Pekudei Lifko is not the only word in Lashon HaKodesh for counting. There is, of course, Minyan and Sefira. Im tuchal lispor otam, that is the common word is lispor. And yet here the Torah does not use the word sfor, as if to say Eile misperei HaMishkan or whatever it may be, but rather Pekudei. And in Lashon HaKodesh, there is no such thing as pure synonyms, that is to say, two words that mean exactly the same thing. If they meant exactly the same thing, they'd be exactly the same word. And therefore, if there are two terms, we are best beckoned to ask, what is the difference between Pekudei and Mispare, Pekida and Sefira? And here, interestingly, there are two approaches to this question. We'll begin with the Acharonim and work our way back to the Rishonim. One of the great Baalei Haloshon, of course, Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, the Ksava Kabbalah, he explains that the reason why we have these two terms for counting, Sefira and Pekida, is because there are actually two ways to count. There is the incremental way in the sense that one starts at one and adds another one and keeps going until one has the final amount. That's called Lispor. One, two, three, and keep going. But there's another type of counting, which is more counting first in subgroups and then adding the groups together. And that actually is what happens, of course, with regards to the Shevatim, where each Shevet or each family gives its Machtes HaShekel, and there are certain amounts that are given for certain things. And each reckoning is made independently, and then all of these subgroups are added up for the subtotal. And that type of counting with groups is known as Pekida. And the reason why it's known as Pekida is because the word Lifkod has another meaning in Lashon HaKodesh, and that is to remember, as in Pakod Pokaditi, Vayelokim Vashem Pokad Es Sora. It means to remember. And the reason how that comes to be a form of counting is because this is a type of counting that requires you to remember, in the sense that if you just start with one and then go two, three, four and keep going, you actually don't need to remember anything. You just keep on adding one. But if you started with a group and you made a certain tally and you put that to the side and start again with another group, you need then to recall the amount in the first group as you put all the groups together. And because this form of counting requires remembering, that is why it is referred to as Pekida. So this is the approach of the Ksava Kabbalah. Very, very interesting. But the question, as we mentioned, as we referred to before, has already been discussed in the Rishonim. The Ramban also raises the question, why does the Torah use the term Pekudei here? And he too draws our attention to the fact that the word lifkod has a connotation of remembering. And how does that relate to the counting here? Because as we know, the Machtes HaShekel, which was given by each person, actually is represents the donor. The Jewish people are not counted directly. This was also a form of a census for the Jewish people. Kisisa es rosh b'nei Yisrael, they were counted via the Machtes HaShekel. When you count someone directly, the person that you're counting is in front of your eyes. But when you count them via something else, so the medium that you're counting is not the one that you actually wish to take a reckoning of, but it brings them to mind because it represents them, which means as Moshe or the Torah are counting the Machtes HaShekel in front of them, they are mindful of something that is not in front of them, which they're not counting directly, namely the Jewish people. And that's why this counting, whereby what's in front of you brings to mind something that is not in front of you, which is its own form of pikida, calling to your attention, that's why this counting is called pikude. So these are some interesting approaches to the very beginning of the parsha, why pikude is called pikude. And here, as we move on to the next two or three psukim, Kaf Beis and Kaf Gimel, we are informed or reminded as to who it was that was in charge of the Mishkan and all associated enterprises. We have in Pasuk Kaf Beis, Ubetzalel, Ben Uri, Ben Hur, Lamatei Yehuda. So we have Betzalel on the one hand, Asa es kol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe. He did all which Hashem commanded Moshe. And then Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Viito, his partner, who is often mentioned less. If we have one name in mind, we think of Betzalel. But the Pasuk appointed two people. Betzalel from the tribe of Yehuda, Viito, Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Ahaliyav ben Achisamach, Lemate Dan, from the tribe of Dan. And the question, again, which is raised by early sources, is what to make of this collaboration? What to make of these two individuals specifically? And moreover, the Pasuk mentions the tribes that they are from, and apparently that's also part of the equation. The someone from the tribe of Yehuda and the someone from the tribe of Dan. I believe the classic answer to this question is that Yehuda was the most numerous of all the tribes, and Dan was the least numerous. So in a sense, you have the greatest and the smallest in terms of numbers. And the Torah sought to give, so to speak, equal representation to not only to the largest of the tribes, but also to the smallest in number, and thus it paired Yehuda and Dan. Everyone else in between was in between. But Rabbeinu Bachya has a fascinating approach to this question. Again, the collaboration of someone from Shevet Yehuda and someone from Shevet of Dan, which reveals a completely new dimension, shall we say, expresses a new dimension to what the Mishkan is all about. As we know, the Mishkan has a great deal of significance to it, specifically in the sense that it is a micro-representation of the entire world. The Mishkan is the original microcosm as a building. All the parts of the Mishkan and the coverings on top and the Kodesh, the Kodesh HaKodashim, all of the Kelim, etc., they represent different aspects of the world itself. And that is why the Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos and Daf Nun Hei that Betzalel was so qualified in the sense that Yodea Haya Betzalel Litzarif Osio Shebehem Nivru Shamayim Va'aretz. Betzalel knew the secret of how to combine letters of Aleph Beis, and the letters of the Aleph Beis represent the primal forces of creation, and he knew how they were combined in order for the world to be created. That's Betzalel's qualifications. When you think about it, he sounds maybe a little overqualified, as if to say, it's just a building. No need to get involved in the creation of the heavens and the earth. But as Reb Chaim of Elojan says in the Sefer Nefesh HaChaim, no, he does need to know exactly how these things combine to create the heavens and the earth, because that is exactly what will be reflected and represented in the creation of the Mishkan. And therefore, he needs to know that knowledge very well. Indeed, as Mefarshim point out, it's for this reason that when we have the mitzvah of Shabbos, which of course the central feature as far as the strict Torah law is concerned, that malacha is forbidden, and we call malacha productive labor. And specifically, we learn which labors are forbidden from the Mishkan. That's from the juxtaposition of Shabbos and the Mishkan. The Torah says, here's how you make the Mishkan, and don't do melacha on Shabbos, and specifically, it's the 39 melachas that were involved in the Mishkan. And Mefarshim raised the question, is that all there is to life, is making a Mishkan? Is it to say the subtotal or the spectrum of creative labor will all be found in the Mishkan, to the extent that when you rest from melacha, look to the Mishkan for your cue? And the answer is yes, because when we remember that we rest from productive labor on Shabbos for melacha in order to commemorate or emulate the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, ki sheish yas yomim, asa Hashem, es ha-shamayim ves-aretz, etc., bayonach, bayom ha-shvi'i, so Hashem created the world and then rested on the seventh, and therefore we too rest on the seventh from melacha, which is involved in the creation of the world. And our closest experience to the creation of the world is the creation of the Mishkan, because the Mishkan reflects in micro the creation of Shemayim Va'aretz. And therefore that is exactly where we take our cue from in order to know which type of melachas we desist from, we rest from, in order to commemorate the Hashem's resting, so to speak, from creating the world. And with this idea in mind, and of course there's many different spheres in which one could develop the idea of the connection between the Mishkan and the world itself, but we go back to Rashi in the beginning of Bereshis. Rashi comments that Bereshis begins only with the name Elohim. Bereshis bara Elohim, Vayomer Elohim, Vayar Elohim, and throughout the first chapter of Bereshis, all you will find is the name of Elohim. It is not until the second chapter where you find the name of Yudkei Vavkei, Vayom Asos Hashem Elohim, Yudkei Vavkei. And what is behind the usage exclusively of Elohim in chapter 1, and then the pairing of the name of Yudkei Vavkei with that name? And Rashi states famously that originally B'techila Allah b'machshava livroso b'midas hadin. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's original thought, so to speak, was to create the world only operating on the pure system of justice, of divine justice. And that is the connotation of the name Elohim. Elohim is a judge and it refers to the attribute of justice. But then, Ra'a she'en ha'olam miskayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw, again, so to speak, that the world couldn't endure. If the world runs in strict justice, the world is not going to run for very long. That's life. And therefore, shitef ima midas harachamim, he partnered the attribute of mercy together with that of din. And that's why you find in the second chapter, Hashem Elohim, those two names together, the attribute of mercy and the attribute of justice. And Mefarshim again raised the question, what is the concept of HaKadosh Baruch Hu originally considering doing it one way, and then seeing that it wouldn't work, and then finally deciding that this is the better way to do it? If HaKadosh Baruch Hu has infinite, absolute knowledge at all times, it's hard to consider the notion of originally considering one thing and then saying, well, maybe that wouldn't really work, and then the first thought is the best way for it to work. One could say that perhaps it's a depiction, the rhetorical lashon b'nei adam, it's just a way of explaining it to us or presenting it in a way that we can relate to. But the Sefer Teras Chaim, Rav Avraham Chaim Shor, one of the great early commentators on certain Masechtas, and here it's on Maseches Bava Kama, he explains that the original thought, that is to say, to create the world with a system of justice, it is the ideal. And the reason why it's the ideal is because man exists in this world in order to develop, in order to earn his level, in order to earn his reward. The more mercy there is, the more it's bestowed, so the less a person actually owns. So from a pure point of view, the ideal really is midas hadin. But there is the reality. And again, the caveat is it's the reality as HaKadosh Baruch Hu created it. But the reality is that may be the ideal, but it won't be served because no one will survive. And an ideal that no one is left around to partake of is not an ideal. But it does remain the ideal. And this is the difference between midas hadin and midas harachamim. Justice elevates the person. Mercy accommodates. And that a person could have without having to do mitzvahs and without having to really invest anything in their spiritual level. Because if it's all given to them, so then they don't need to be involved in human endeavor. And thus you have the, it remains the ideal, and that's reflected in the fact that the name Elohim is the only name that appears in chapter 1, as if to say, that is a reality. It wasn't originally a good idea, but then this is a better idea. It remains the best idea, but then not everyone can abide by it. Some people can. An example of just such a person, says the Toras Chaim, is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, we know, had a very, very difficult end, a very gruesome and death. And in fact, the Gemara states in Maseches Menachos, in Daf Kaf Tes, that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he went up to receive the Torah, at the beginning of day 40, so he's just beginning, and he is treated to a guest appearance within one of Rabbi Akiva's shiurim. He's transported into the future, into Rabbi Akiva's shiur. The Gemara says he sat at the back, which is probably for the best, not to cause too much commotion, as I think Moshe Rabbeinu comes into the shiur, it will probably distract certain people. He sat at the back, and he was very, very impressed with Rabbi Akiva. And then he says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so what will be with him? Har'eini Sofo, show me his end. How does he end? How does he leave the world? And Rabbi Akiva left the world under the most difficult and trying and torturous of circumstances. And Moshe says, well, how can it be? Voicing the famous question, Zu Torah v'zu Schara, that's his Torah and that's his reward. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu's answer to Moshe is with the words, Amarlo Shesok. He said, be silent. Kach ala b'machshav lefanai. That's what I've decided. That's the simple reading of the Gemara. That's what I've decided. Kach ala b'machshav lefanai. As if to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying to Moshe, you won't understand it, I don't want to explain it to you, and just be silent, and it's just not a topic for conversation. These are my thoughts, and you can't fathom them, and that's that. But the Toras Chaim says no. With these words, Kach ala b'machshava lefanai, this was the thought that arose before me. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not avoiding answering the question. He is answering the question, because the answer is that this is Midas Hadid. This is the attribute of justice, where there is absolute comeuppance and absolute accountability for every single thing. And what it means is that this is a person, kach ala b'machshava lefanai, this is a person who is able to abide by the original thought that I had in creating the world, which remains the ideal. Mitchila ala b'machshava livrosa b'midas hadin. The original thought was to create the world with midas hadin. For people like Rabbi Akiva, kach ala b'machshava, this was the ideal. Coming back to the Mishkan, and indeed as the Or Chaim HaKadosh says, just to go back to Rabbi Akiva, in his Sefer Chefetz Hashem, which is one of his works on the Gemara, the Gemara says that when Rabbi Akiva died, Yotza Baskol, a heavenly voice came out and proclaimed, Ashrecha Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is mezuman l'chaye olam haba. He's ready for life in the world to come. And the Or Chaim HaKadosh says, well, don't we say that Kol Yisrael Yishlem Cholok L'Olam Haba? Don't we say that everyone is, unless they take themselves out of it? But it sounds like Rabbi Akiva's case was so unique that it warranted and deserved a baskel to say that Rabbi Akiva is a Ben Olam Haba. If you need to announce it for Rabbi Akiva, it sounds like everyone else is in trouble. It sounds like he was a special case. But that's the rule. Kol Yisrael Yishlem Cholok L'Olam Haba. Says the Or Chaim HaKadosh, everyone has a chelek, but there's certain things that need to happen before they get to Olam Haba. There's certain reckonings that need to take place. Rabbi Akiva was exceptional, not that he had a chelek in Olam Haba, but as the Gemara says, he is mezuman lechay Olam Haba. Mezuman, which is a word that I think we're familiar with in Israel, mezuman, cash, no need to wait, it's ready, it's here. There were no outstanding issues with Rabbi Akiva. Because he abided purely by Midas Hadin, his way to Olam Haba was direct, and that really was a unique situation as expressed by that Baskol. Well, having discussed, and there's much more to discuss, but for our purposes, having discussed the understanding that a central part of the conceptual underpinnings of the creation of the world is the twinning of Midas Harachamim and Midas Hadin, of mercy and of justice, says Rabbeinu Bachya, let us come back to consider the two tribes that were involved and commissioned with overseeing the construction of the Mishkan. They were Betzalel from the tribe of Yehuda and Ahaliah from the tribe of Dan. And what are the unique qualities, shall we say, of these two tribes? Yehuda, says Rabbeinu Bachya, corresponds to Midas HaRachamim, and that is why Yehuda actually contains all the letters in sequence of the name of Yudke Vavke. The Dalet at the end, it relates to the concept of Malchus, and that's David, and so on and so forth, but it embodies and reflects the concept of Midas HaRachamim, Yudke Vavke. Dan, of course, is Din, Danya Dinamo, and therefore Yehuda and Dan combine in the construction of the Mishkan, corresponding to the fact that the world itself is a combination of Midas HaRachamim and Midas HaDin, and the Mishkan reflects that. And this is the very interesting explanation of Rabbeinu Bachya regarding the choice of representatives from those two tribes specifically to oversee the construction of the Mishkan. Now, as we move deeper into the Parsha, we see that there is a phrase, it is repeated a number of times. It's almost the refrain, shall we say, of the Parsha. And that is the expression, Ka'asher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. It appears no less than 18 times. Who's counting? But they are 18. And it keeps on recurring. And of course the question is, why is this expression, and you hear it echoes throughout the laning, Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe, Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. What is behind this repetition? Interestingly, these 18 repetitions impact on our daily practice in a way that we might not otherwise be aware. The Gemara in Maseches Brachos in the fourth parak in Daf Kaf Ches discusses the Shmona Esrei Brachos, and the Gemara discusses what do these 18 brachos correspond to, and it gives a number of answers. Some of them may be well known, some of them perhaps less so. The 18 vertebrae, right, the critical vertebrae in the spine. The 18 mentions of Hashem's name in Kriyat Shema, or as we mentioned 2 weeks ago, the 18 references of Hashem's name in Tehillim number 29, Hovel Hashem B'nei Elim, Hovel Hashem Kovel V'Oz. And of course, each of those associations itself needs to then be explored. What is the connection between the brachos of Shmona Esrei and the spine, or the Shema, or that chapter of Tehillim? But those are the three answers that are to be found in the Gemara Brachos, Talmud Bavli. However, the Yerushalmi there in the fourth Berak of Brachos gives us another association, and that is that it corresponds to the 18 times in Parshas Pekudei in the construction of the Mishkan where it says Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. And that is the one, of course, Davar Be'ito, that we will be focusing on for the next while. What's the brachos of Shmona Esrei got to do with Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe, to the extent that then that number corresponds to that number, Kol Zeh Omer Darshedi. Or as they like to say, Israeli children, it's their favorite question, Ma Kesher. So let us begin, and this question is discussed by the Beis Halevi in one of his lengthy essays within his Sefer. And he begins by drawing our attention to a well-known comment of Rashi. Rashi quotes his Rebbe, Rebbe Moshe Hadarshan, in the beginning of Parshas Chukas, who says, with regards to Parah Aduma, Parshas Chukas, as we know, deals with Parah Aduma, Zos Chukas HaTorah, and Rashi quotes, this actually, the concept, the core concept is from the Medrash, that the Parah Aduma comes as a kapara, as an atonement for the Chet HaEgel. There's even that mashal of the child, and the child made a mess, and they said, let the mother come and clean up the mess of the child. So too, the mess here was performed through the Egel. So that the mother come, let the Parah Aduma come and clean it up. The problem, of course, is that the very notion of explaining what the Parah Aduma does sounds like a doomed venture by definition, because the Parah Aduma is introduced as Chukas HaTorah, as the quintessential Chok of the Torah, and Chok refers to a type of mitzvah whose reason is beyond human comprehension. Which means this is the one mitzvah, if there's any mitzvah, it's the one mitzvah where Rashi really could have taken the day off. I mean, it could, when it says those Chukas HaTorah, and Rashi says, well, there it is, Chukas HaTorah, don't look to me for explanations. And Rashi doesn't normally provide explanations for the mitzvahs. And of all mitzvahs here, Rashi says, you know what the Paraduma is about? It comes to atone for the Chetah Egel. But by definition, if you look back at the words Chukas HaTorah, you know that any suggestion must be flawed. Even Shlomo HaMelech, famously in Koheles, he writes about the Paraduma, Amarti Echkama, Vehirachoka Mimeni, to Koheles Perek Zion. I thought I would be wise. He was 6'12 for 6'12. He saved the best for last. Paraduma. I thought I'd be wise, Vehirachoka Mimeni, but it's beyond me. It eludes me. It's a shame. Should have looked in Rashi, in the beginning of Parshas Chukas. He would have gotten the answer. That it would have been a perfect 613. So how does Rashi know what Shlomo HaMelech doesn't know? The Medrash makes an association that seems so simple as to actually be very difficult. The Medrash says that it was a good thing for the Jewish people to say Na'aseh v'nishma. So far, we concur. However, says the Medrash, it was not a good thing for them to say Eile Elohecha Yisrael, which is what they said when the Egel came out. And that's it. That's what the Medrash says. Now, when the Medrash is challenging, at least we know what to expect. But when the Medrash says something which is so, we know that Na'aseh v'nishma was a good thing, and we know that accepting the golden calf as a deity is a bad thing. So, for the Medrash to make those two statements and to contrast the two leaves us more flummoxed than ever. Because what's the point of the Medrash? One is clearly positive, and one is clearly negative. There is a further statement in the Medrash that associates and links the Chetah Egel all the way back to the sin of Adam HaRishon. How so? It's in the Shir Shayom for Tuesday morning, which starts by saying, we know the Psukim well, Ani Amarti Elohim Atem, right? I thought it's towards the end of that, it's a short mizmor. I thought, or I said, that you would be like higher forces, uvni elyon kulchem, and like children of on high, achein ke adam temusin, but indeed you die like man. That's the pasuk, and the Medrash explains that when we stood at Har Sinai, even death couldn't reach us, and that was the what we could have attained. Ani amarti Elohim atem uvni elyon kulchem, that you'd be like angels and that you'd be like people of on high. But then we made the Egel, and everything crashed, and death came back into the world for the Jewish people, and that's why the pasuk says Achein ke Adam tamusin, just so you'll die like Adam, meaning like the original Adam, who also could have evaded death, but because of his wrong decisions, he walked into it, and it's the same thing. The question, of course, is how is it the same thing? There are both sins. But it almost sounds like the Chetah Egel is like a rehash of the Chet of Adam HaRishon. What's one thing got to do with the other? I think we have enough problems just dealing with the Egel itself. The Beis Halevi explains, and it's a delicate discussion, obviously, by definition. But what's so difficult about the Chetah Egel is that the Jewish people were on a high madrega, but something happened. They took a wrong turn. And what would that be? On the one hand, clearly in the absence of Moshe, and the very fact that they're looking to replace Moshe means it doesn't sound like Avodah Zarah pure, because they never said they're looking to replace HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they're just looking to replace Moshe. So Moshe's role was a means through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicated with them. And they're looking for a way to have that communication in the absence of Moshe, something else should substitute. And they choose an Egel. Where did they go wrong? Says Beis Halevi, there's one fundamental premise here. And that is, our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't start by us in a vacuum setting the plan as to what is the best way to arrange that relationship. In the same way that originally when Moshe was there, we received direction from Moshe, so too, and you can really see it in the way that the people related to Aaron here. After all, without loading the question too much, if Moshe's gone missing, and you need a substitute for Moshe, isn't he standing right in front of you? Isn't it Aaron? As far as many people were concerned, Aaron was meant to be the leader in the first place. That was their expectation, that is to say. Aaron was with them in Mitzrayim all those years, and he was prophesying in Mitzrayim. People didn't know Moshe. So of course, when Moshe comes on the scene, and Aaron, being Aaron, steps to the side, graciously and happily, and Moshe steps forward. But if Moshe goes missing, so the default is back to Aaron for sure. Which means what we would have expected to happen, again, in hindsight, we have the comfort of expecting this to happen, is that the Jewish people should have approached Aaron and said, Moshe's gone missing, please tell us now, what should we do? But what they did was they went to Aaron and they said, now that Moshe's gone, here is what we want you to do. And there was an offer that he couldn't refuse, as we know from the Midrashim, who stood up and was killed. That is an absolute reversal, in a sense, of the flow of communication, of direction. It's the Jewish people insisting that we're going to direct how it's going to go. And if you're Aaron, so you know how to make an eagle. So make an eagle for us. That's the way forward. And in a sense, the problem that lay at the root of the Chet HaEgel was a mishandling of the faculty of human intellect, which is a divinely given koach that allows a person to understand what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying to him. But ego can very rapidly develop that into the sense of how best to navigate one's way through life, even in terms of one's relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even contrary to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's own wishes and express commands. A person has finite intellect, but he has an infinite capacity to assess his and appraise the extent of his intellect. And this brings us back to Na'aseh V'Nishma and what the Medrash means to indicate by putting these two as davar v'hipucho, as opposites to each other. The Medrash says, it was good to say Na'aseh V'Nishma. It wasn't good to say Eile Elohecha Yisrael. What the Medrash means to say is that the Egel was the opposite of Na'aseh V'Nishma. It was the undoing of Na'aseh V'Nishma. Not just, quote-unquote, that was a mitzvah, and this is an avera. That was a positive thing, and this is a negative thing. But rather, the whole image that the Jewish people have about their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Na'aseh V'Nishma means, and of course, whenever we say the phrase Na'aseh V'Nishma, we're mindful of the fact that it's backwards. Because Na'aseh means we'll do, and Nishma means we'll hear, but of course, practically, you can't do anything until you've heard, so there's not much Na'aseh going on until you've done the Nishma. So it should have been Nishma V'Na'aseh, we will hear and we will do. What is the meaning of saying Na'aseh V'Nishma? We will do and we will hear means that we accept to do even before we've heard. In other words, the answer is yes, Na'aseh. Of course, we don't know what to do yet. Okay, we'll hear. But we don't need to hear in order to say yes. As if to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's infinite wisdom has credit by us. And what he directs us to do, we understand, is the best for us. We would not necessarily have intuited those actions ourselves. Okay, for that we leave it up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is a healthy relationship. That's called Na'aseh V'Nishma. Eile Elokecha Yisrael, whereby Moshe's gone and we now have our ideas, and if Aaron exists, it's only to fulfill the way that we think we should go. We're not interested in what he says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu thinks. Even in terms of our relationship with him, capital H. So that is the opposite of Na'aseh V'Nishma. And interestingly, this was not the first mistake of its kind. Because when we come back to the idea of the Eitz Hadas, of the original sin, again, another mystery. Adam is Yashar, he wants to do the right thing. If he wants to do the right thing, how does he choose to do the wrong thing? As the Rizal explains, it must be that he chose to do the wrong thing for the right reasons. Meaning, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has said, that tree isn't good for you. That whole way of looking at things, whatever is included within Eitz Hadas Tova Ra, as Ramban, for example, explains, it means there are certain impulses and urges towards evil and inclinations that didn't exist prior to that. So stay away. Don't get involved. And so now, what does Adam do? He gets involved. But how can he justify it? He's violating a direct command from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the point is, says the Arizal, Adam reasons. This is Adam or Nacha or the Nachash, the snake, feeding this to Adam, or actually feeding this to Chava. It's always important, for women to take credit where credit is due. The original conversation takes place between the Nachash and Chava. And then Adam, if at all, is presented more as the victim here. But let's assume that he's part of it. But they're all part of it. It's called the Chet Adam Arishon. Chavit's got sidelined a little bit. Incorrectly so. And what's the argument? The argument is, it's no chachma to serve Hashem if you have no impulses towards evil. And he gave you this mitzvah, and it's very easy. Won't it be better? Won't it be a deeper form of service of Hashem if you actually have these impulses and overcome them? That's exercising your free will for the glory of God. So it's better. There's just one thing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told you not to do it. Not to eat from that tree and not to get into that whole mode of existence. But the argument is, yes, I know. And I know that in the interim it's a violation of a direct command, but the ends justify the means. In the end, Hashem will see things my way. He'll see that it was better. And that is the beginnings of what would later become the Chet HaEgel. It's the compulsion of a person that to impose their plan on top of, or instead of, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan. When Hashem comes to give Musar, so to speak, when he comes to give to chastise and rebuke Adam for eating from the tree, he says, Me'al Sisa, what did you do? Hamina eats. It's from the tree Asher Tzivisicha Levoltiacha Mimena Achalta. It's from the tree that I told you not to eat from. You ate. It's a very wordy way of rebuking Adam, and we know which tree it is. Mina Eitz, from the, why not just call it Eitz Hadas Tova Ra? But he described it as the tree that I told you not to eat from, you ate from. So the Beis Halevi explains that with these words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is helping Adam. I'm just giving a bit of insight into himself, as if to say, you're probably wondering, now that it's all gone horribly wrong, how did you ever come to eat from the tree? It's the one tree that's no good for you. But why did you eat from it? So I'll explain it to you. And please remember this, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Adam. The most compelling reason you had to eat from the tree is because I told you not to eat from the tree. That already set you up in conflict in terms of whose plan will out, who has the better plan. Once you have a command, that now is the question. Are you okay with receiving a command from infinite wisdom? Or will you insist on coming up with something better? The very tzivui is what got you going, and it remains so. The Gemara itself draws an association between the flow between the original sin of Eitz Hadas and subsequent sin of Egel, because the Gemara says that when Adam and Chava ate from the Eitz Hadas, there was a certain venom that was injected in them by the snake Zuama, certain infection, and that cleared up when they stood at Har Sinai. So says the Gemara. And the Medrash continues, but it came back at the time of the Egel. You see, that condition, the original fall, they refell at the time of the Egel because it was the same issue. And that is why the Pasuk says, Achein ke'odom te'musun. But however, you will die like man, meaning because you went through the same experience and you made the same mistake that Adam made at the time of the making of the Egel. And that's why the results are the same. And the result is death, because man, in choosing his own plan, very simply parts ways from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who's the source of life. So death is not just, quote-unquote, a punishment. It's an inevitable consequence. If a person distances themselves from life, so that's what there is. All this, says the Beis HaLevi, brings us back to Para Aduma. Para Aduma, the enigma, the elusive, the unfathomable. It's a chok, we don't understand it. So chok says, we don't know why we do it. Rashi says, it comes as a kapara for the eagle. That's a contradiction, because you can't say that. After all, we don't know. So how can Rashi then say that the Para Aduma is an atonement for the Cheta Egel? Says the Beis Halevi, the reality is that we do not know why we do the Para Aduma. It's a chok. We don't know, but we do it, because the Torah says. And that's the kapara for the Cheta Egel. As if to say, the idea that we are accepting that there is a mitzvah out there and we don't understand it, but it's in the Torah, and if the Torah says it, so then that's what we do. That's the kapara. So it's a loop. The point is, or it's oblique. It's not that the goal of the Para Aduma comes and that's its meaning is to be mechaper. We don't know its meaning. But if we do it anyway, that's what's mechaper. And therefore, says Beis Halevi, we now understand why in the construction of the Mishkan, and as we know, the Mishkan is a major part of the rehabilitation of the Jewish people from the Cheta Egel. Whether it's according to Rashi that the entire concept of the Mishkan was only communicated post-Egel, or even for Ramban, that the idea was communicated beforehand, shelved, and then brought back after the Egel, by the time we come to make the Mishkan, it is for sure a part of our recovery from the Egel. And that is why, with so much going on in the Mishkan, and so much that one could intuit as to what it's all about, and that's part of it, but the fundamental motivation of those involved in every stage of the Mishkan is Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. That's what Hashem told Moshe. That's what Moshe told us that Hashem said. And if you want to know the short answer as to why we're making the Mishkan, that is the short answer. And if there's only one answer, that is the answer. There's much more to say, but that's at the heart, and that's also part of the tikkun of the Cheta Egel. Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. It's repeated again and again. Now, the Beis Hamikdash is a center of two parts of Jewish life. It is the center, of course, of Avodah. That's where Korbanos are, Aliyah L'Regel. It is the the Avodah center, but it's also the center of Torah, because the highest Sanhedrin sits there on the premises in a place which is called the Lishkas Hagozis. You've heard the expression, the Lishkas HaGozis, translated as the chamber of hewn stone. Gozis means you sew. Weird. Now, Rav Aryeh Kaplan raises a simple question. Lishkas HaGozis, you know, of all the names that you think for the chamber where the Sanhedrin sits, we could have come up with something a little bit more colorful, a little bit with more personality, a little bit more imaginative than the chamber of hewn stones. Most people sit in a chamber of hewn stones. If your house was made for you and the stones were shaped, so then that's a chamber of hewn stones. It doesn't really seem to give too much away. It seems to be rather drab as names go. And that's the name. Lishkas HaGozis. Why is that such a key factor here? But it's interesting that the word Gozis is found in the Torah in terms of how the Torah says not to make the Mizbeach. It says if you make a Mizbeach out of stones, Lo Sivna Eshen Gozis, do not have them hewn stones. What do they need to be? Avonim Shleimos. They need to be untouched, just as nature intended. Full, whole stones, not shaped in any way. So that's very interesting, because now we see in terms of the setting, and again, Torah and Avodah, they're right next to each other in the Beis HaMikdash, but they're contrasted in this way. Namely, that for Torah, it's hewn stones, they're cut and shaped, and for Avodah, they're specifically not touched at all. And what does this now reflect? Says Rav Aryeh Kaplan, it reflects the difference between Torah and Avodah. As if to say, man exists in the world in two capacities, and he needs to be aware of both. And they don't contradict each other, but they're part of the duality, really, of man. Namely, on the one hand, man is meant to Reduas Haaretz, he's meant to conquer, he's meant to impose, he's meant to cultivate and to develop and to create. And he has all those capacities. But they come to an end, they have limitations, and he needs to recognize those limitations. And from a certain point of view, there comes a time when the very same creative man, he's frail and he's vulnerable, he's prone to error, he's prone to weakness, and he's prone to failure. And he needs help. And both are true. And they represent the areas of Torah and Avodah. Torah, on the one hand, is where you'll see the Sanhedrin representing, in spiritual terms, creativity. They're shaping, and they're cutting, and they're paskening, and they're darshaning, and they're ruling, and they're innovating, and within the parameters of the way Sanhedrin could do it. It's the height of, in a sense, of spiritual creativity. Avodah is where man's limitations are recognized, and they need to be recognized, otherwise he's deluding himself. He may see himself as infinitely capable and so on and so forth. And that is why the place where the Sanhedrin sits is called Lishkas Hagozis. It reflects their ability to cut and shape things, as opposed to the Avodah, where nothing is touched. It's exactly natural. Don't touch it, because you'll ruin it, and you don't have the capacity, and it's all about man's limitations. Interestingly, according to the Rashba in the Tshuvas, this is what is behind the idea of standing with feet together during Shmona Esrei. The Gemara actually draws the association with Malachim in Brachos and Daf Yud, Veragleihem Regel Yeshara, that they have like one leg and therefore also it's like a voda, it's a very high level. But the Rashba says additionally, a person stands with his legs with his feet together because he can't move. He's recognizing that he can't move without HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And indeed, says Rashba, not only should feet be together, also hands should be together, although depending on how the hands are together, they might have other associations. People have claimed that for their own prayers. So it kind of fell into disuse a little bit. But it's that idea, hands together, feet together, bound, restricted, limited. That's part of the reality of man, and it goes together. It brings to mind a very interesting comment of Rav Kook, that's all. The Gemara, more correctly, the Mishnah, in the fifth parak of Brachos and Daf Lamed Gimel, it talks about a number of things that if a person says them in his davening, we silence him. It's a very short list. Not many things that you actively silence the person for saying. It could be the list has grown since then, but in the Mishnah, there's three things on the list. If he says modim modim, he thinks he's adding praise, but it could give a concept of maybe two deities. Better leave it out. He says modim modim, leave it out. One modim is fine. And so on and so forth. And one of the things on that list, as the Mishnah is, if the person says, Al kan sipor yagira chamecha, may your mercy extend to the mother's nest. And the Gemara explains what that means is, he says it as a form of prayer. Namely, in the same way that you had Rachmanos on the mother bird, in the midst of kan sipor, you send her away, she shouldn't see her young being taken, so too have Rachmanos on us. That's his prayer. And the Mishnah says, if a person says that, you silence him. And the Gemara says, why? That sounds like a good prayer. Why would you silence him? And the Gemara answers, because he's got the wrong idea about what mitzvahs are. He's making them into exercises in mercy, but they're not. They're divine decrees. Oso midosav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu rachamim ve'eino ela gezeiros. That's what the Gemara says. So it sounds like the moral of the story is that if a person tries to ascribe moral reasons for mitzvahs, we silence it because they're just decrees and you don't know. However, as Mefarshim point out, aren't we encouraged to try and see moral reasons within mitzvahs? Aren't we encouraged to try and be involved in the area known as Tamei HaMitzvahs, to see how they do develop middos? And this question is discussed by Rishonim. And Rav Kook, although the roots are earlier, but the way it's expressed by Rav Kook is, we are encouraged to give reasons for mitzvahs. You know where? In the Beis HaMedrash. Because that's where man is creative, and that's where he intuits, and that's where he fathoms, and that's where he understands, and suggests, and argues, and defends, and attacks. And if you want to say it in the Beis HaMedrash, I think this could be a reason for Shiluach HaKen, Good for you. You can make Birchas HaTorah and go straight into that dissertation on the mitzvah. You know where it's not in place? When you're davening. It is so antithetical to what davening is, because davening is a recognition of man's limitations, his limitations in terms of what he can do and what he can understand. It is contrary to the ethos of what davening is, because davening is hands together, feet together, and brain together. That means that you're aware that there's so much that we don't understand. That's not the time to start injecting your dissertation about how this mitzvah works and that mitzvah works, and that's what my tefillah is based on. Your tefillah representing your limitation. It cannot be based on your theories, which are part of the chamber of hewn stone. Don't bring them onto the mizbeach. That's how Rav Kook explains. We don't, because the Mishnah says we silence him if he says it within the context of tefillah, but if he says it within the context of Divrei Torah, we'll congratulate him. We'll give him yashar koach. Everything in its time and its place. And once we appreciate this aspect of what tefillah is, and tefillah is many things, but this is a key aspect, that recognizing that man is finite and has weaknesses and limitations and shortcomings, perhaps now we can understand why the Yerushalmi says that the 18 brachas of Shemana Esrei correspond to the 18 times that it says in our parsha, Kasher Tziv Hashem Es Moshe, closing the circle. That is to say, what's one thing got to do with the other? Because as we saw from the Beis Halevi, that reiteration, that repetition 18 times, Kasher Tziv Hashem Es Moshe, is the Jewish people recognizing that there's certain things they don't understand. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what's best for them, and that's also part of being successful in life. You've got to know your kochos, you have to know your limitations. And when it comes to making the Mishkan, especially to recover from taking that terrible wrong turn at the time of the Egel, it's all Kasher Tziv Hashem Es Moshe. And that very recognition is what runs through, dare I say it, the backbone of the Shemona Esrei, which is the quintessence of tefillah. And that's why the number of brachas is modeled no less on the amount of times that concept is emphasized in the original recovery from the Egel, where it says, Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. Well, as we come to the end of the Parsha, and we see in Perek, Perek Lamites, Pasuk Mem Gimel. Pasuk Mem Gimel, Vayar Moshe es kol hamalacha, Perek Lamites, Pasuk Mem Gimel. Moshe saw all of the work, all of the labor. V'inei osu asa kashet siva Hashem kein asu. They had indeed performed it exactly as Hashem commanded, so did they do. Vayivorech osam Moshe. And Moshe blessed them. And even the Medrash Tanchuma draws a parallel between this, because you can almost hear the echoes. It's all done now. Vayar lekimas kol asher asav v'inei tov ma'od vayivorech, right? Hashem looked at the world, it all came out well, obviously, and Hashem blessed it. And here's Moshe. He sees they've performed the Mishkan, they've constructed it, corresponding to creation of the world, and therefore he gave them the corresponding bracha. The Pasuk doesn't say what the bracha was, it just says vayivorech asav. Rashi quotes from the Medrash. Amar lehem, he said to them, may it be Hashem's will that the divine presence rest in the work of your hands. That's the pasuk. Now that pasuk is from Tehillim, but lest we wonder how can Moshe be pre-quoting a pasuk in Tehillim, a number of Tehillim were authored by Moshe Rabbeinu. There are 10 co-authors of Tehillim. David HaMelech authored many of his and brought them all together. Some of them authored by Moshe, 11 in fact, beginning with the one which starts, Tefillah LaMoshe, Ish Elokim. And the final pasuk of that mizmor is, Vinom Hashem Elokeinu Aleinu, may Hashem be pleased, the pleasantness will rest upon us, Umasi Adenu Kodenu Aleinu, the work of our hands should be established. That's the bracha that Moshe gave them. And the question is, what does he mean by this? May the Shechinah rest in the work of your hands. There's a very interesting comment of Rav Shlomo Kluger relating to Pasuk Lamed Beis of Perek Lamed Tes. Pasuk Lamed Beis says, "Vateichel kol avodas Mishkan Oel Moed." All the work of the Mishkan was done, was concluded. Vayasu bnei Yisrael kechol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe kein asu. The Jewish people did everything Hashem commanded Moshe, so did they do. Pasuk Lamed Beis. And Rav Shlomo Kluger and many Mefarshim raised the question. The order of the Pasuk is backwards, because it starts by saying they finished everything, and then concludes by saying they did everything that Hashem told Moshe, but that's what they did before, because that led to its conclusion. It should have been the other way around. The Jewish people did everything Hashem told Moshe, and the whole thing was finished, but it sounds like the whole thing is finished, and then it says that they did everything Hashem told Moshe. Why does it say that after everything's finished? What else is there to do? So Shlomo Kluger says there's one important, critical way that the Mishkan should not be abused. After all, the Mishkan is a center for korbanos, and korbanos bring kapara, bring atonement, which means that from a certain point of view, there may be a notion that if we don't have a Mishkan, we can't afford not to do what Hashem says, because then what are we going to do? But if we have the antidote in front of us, so that one may have thought that you could take advantage of that, and that could lead to people perhaps being not as scrupulous and careful in terms of everything that Hashem told Moshe they need to do, because worst case scenario, we've got the Mishkan right here, we could bring a korban and make it all better again. And that's why the emphasis is, as much as everything's finished, and as much as you have now this center of korbanos, but the Jewish people, to their credit, they didn't use that as a pretext to then lapse in terms of their mitzvah observance, but rather they continued. It brought out the best in them to do what Hashem said. Better not to need a korban, just not even though the opportunity is there. What's fascinating is, Rav Chaim Friedlander, in the Sefer Sifsei Chaim, he brings us back to Rashi's comment in the Medrash. Moshe says, May the divine presence rest on the work of your hands, the ma'asei yadeichem, the deeds of your hands. And what does that mean? So on a straightforward level, we understand that it means you made the Mishkan. The goal of the Mishkan is for the divine presence to dwell here, and may it be Hashem's will that that happens. The divine presence should rest in the work of your hands. But the Reb Chaim Friedlander says no. Moshe's bracha is, now that you've made a Mishkan, and now that there's a Mishkan in the middle of the camp, so the greatest bracha is that that should affect everything that happens in the camp. May the divine presence rest in the deeds of your hands, wherever you are. As if to say, this should be an inspiration, the fact that the Mishkan is there in the middle, everything should change in the camp that is encamped around it. And all the things that you do, not just in the Mishkan, even out of the Mishkan, the whole camp in that whole radius, because it's centered around the Mishkan, So then, being mindful of that, and taking guidance from that, the Shekhinah should rest in the work of your hands, whatever you do, because there's the Mishkan in the middle. It should change everything. It should make a difference to everything. That's the bracha, and that bracha then ripples out for all of the machaneh. That's Moshe's blessing to them at that time. We'll leave it over here for this evening. Chazak, chazak, v'nis chazak.